Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome, Wycliffe Podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, over the long decades of violence and conflict in the north of this island, there was one very distinctive voice who constantly popped up in a whole range of media. I'm talking about the journalist Eamon Malley, whose name I'm sure will be familiar to all of you of a certain age. For those yet to reach a station of, of any level of a mature demographic, shall we say, Eamon Malley was the man who usually had the story, who often had the crucial interview, and whose analysis was always worth hearing. Over the course of his career, he also made some extraordinary friends, not least the firebrand extremist unionist Ian Paisley. Well, he was certainly extremist at an earlier stage of his career. I think he softened perhaps a little later. We'll talk to Eamon about that. But he apparently took a liking to Eamon, who is a Catholic by birth and a native of South Armagh, an unlikely friendship, one might have thought. Eamon also had reason to enjoy the hospitality and some friendship with Charles J. High, another man with a controversial past, and those are just two of the very noted figures whom he became familiar with through his work over the course of the Troubles in the North. Eamon has now written a fascinating account of his years in journalism entitled Eyewitness to War and Peace, and he joins us now. Eamon, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much indeed.
Eamon, I suppose to start at the beginning, as they say, you're, as I mentioned, you're from South Armagh, you grew up there, and I suppose, even by your own account, a kind of an unlikely beginning for somebody who was going to rise to the top of the media world.
Well, I suppose if you come from South Armagh, you see it as the home of the universe. We're very proud, and I'm very proud of South Armagh. I carried South Armagh around in my heart everywhere I went. I loved South Armagh, and I resented Merlin Rees, the former Secretary of State's reference to South Armagh being banned that country. Yes, the IRA had a big presence in South Armagh, but for the vast number of people in South Armagh, the IRA's activities didn't represent the people of the community. So to call a banded country was such an offensive term, and I still haven't got over that description of the place which I called home.
And you were from there, you went to college in Trinity in Dublin, and then you moved towards the media world in Belfast. I think, did you get an early start with the BBC?
Yes, for a short time, but I did some research in RTE in Irish language. I did Irish and Spanish in Trinity, but I knew it wasn't going to work out there. My NUJ card was blocked, so the chances of getting any serious employment there, I felt, weren't great. So I applied for a job in the BBC, and didn't get the first one for which I went, but I got the next one. And that was a rather sort of difficult patch as well. Remember, I was coming from South Armagh, and I had a certain way of talking, local accent and that type of thing. I think I discovered a certain hostility, probably in those days, because I was Catholic, I was from South Armagh, and I probably emitted a certain arrogance as well. Now, I don't know whether that was due to absolute confidence or insecurity or what it was, but I was certainly resented by my boss. And no matter what I proposed, he shut me down. He said, be done before you buy. And I'd have to remind him, sorry, it has just happened. That's the environment in which I was working. And then commercial radio was born in Northern Ireland at that time, downtown radio. And I literally phoned Louis Kelly up, the editor, in the newsroom, and I said, I'd like to come to see him. I had no interview, and I was automatically employed. I imagine, no interview, nothing. And I felt at home immediately when I walked into that newsroom. It was lively, it was fresh, it was fast happening, and some interesting people. But again, I met my enemies, historical enemies, given from where I came. It wasn't always pleasant. It took me a while to come to terms with it. At one point, I actually had drafted a few notes to say I was going to resign. But one of the people there, Don Anderson, he was extraordinary. He said, Eamon, go down, put your head down, and you rise above them all. I have every confidence in you. And I went down, and the father of the chapel, Maurice Hawkins, a Protestant from Ballycarry in County Antrim, he made me his deputy in the union. And from that day until the day that I walked away from Downtown Radio, I didn't look back.
Yeah, I suppose for listeners who may not be familiar, when you say the father of the chapel, of course, that's the local union rep within an organisation. Yes. Some people aren't totally familiar with that. Eamon, an interesting thing you mentioned there. And as you say, you certainly felt that perhaps there was some resentment towards you because of your origins and coming from the Catholic community. And professionally, I think it's, and I've observed your work even before I got into this business myself. I'm a few years younger, you're not too many, but a few. And I have to say, what really stands out was your capacity for balance and neutrality in reporting what was at times so difficult. And I'm just wondering, that it would strike me with some achievement, particularly as you experienced yourself what you would regard as perhaps prejudice or resentment because you're from a minority tradition there.
Yes, you could say that. But I think it was something to do again with my personality. I didn't ever patronize people. I was in very, very sticky situations. I remember in Ballymena one night, Ian Paisley was giving it his all. And I would reckon I was the only Catholic in that gathering. I was recording what Mr. Paisley was saying. And he had the crowd really revved up. And I was wondering, is it possible that I could get lynched here tonight? And just at that point in time, he turned round and he said, Eamon is a Roman Catholic, but I like him. The mood changed immediately. And I think with all respect, Ian Paisley provided cover for me a lot of the time in the Protestant loyalist community when emotions were running very high. I think when people saw that Paisley liked me, it made it easier for them to adjust to me. During Drumcree, when the Orange men were pushing to march down Gavahi Road around the time of the annual 12th parades, I drove to Portadown, and on the way I had to cross a bridge because I'd gone there to try and get an interview with the chief constable who was giving a press conference in the town. And God, the anger of the crowd on the bridge. And I wondered, would I get through it or would I get lynched? And again, I didn't patronize them. I said, look, lads, the chief constable's giving a press conference. I've got to get in. Any chance of getting through? And one of them said, okay, Eamon, let him pass. Let him through. So I think it's all got to do with your approach. You've got to just treat people as ordinary people. Treat them with respect and they'll respect you. Yeah. But if you look down on them, I think that you'll be in trouble.
No, one of the seminal events and absolutely one of the most harrowing events throughout the period of the Troubles was the hunger strikes in 1981. And you were, I think it's fair to say, in the prime of your career at that stage, and you were very much plugged into what was going on. And you actually met Bobby Sands around that period as well. Tell us a bit about that, Eamon.
Well, I did the unprecedented. I asked for a meeting with a UVF prisoner and an IRA prisoner in the jail in the maze at that point in time. And why I was admitted to the jail, I still don't know. It was such an odd thing to do. And then to be allowed in was remarkable. And I met this Portadown Protestant, the member of the UVF. And I have to say, I found that he was a very nice fellow, a reasonable fellow, and I had a very productive conversation with him. And then I was taken to another area and I met a man called Ribbert O'Shaughnessy. I had never heard of Ribbert O'Shaughnessy. I knew nothing about him. I hadn't been briefed in advance about that name. And it turned out to be Bobby Sands. And from the minute that I walked into that area of the jail until the minute I left an hour later, Sands spoke Irish nonstop with a perfect fluency. My discipline was Irish in Trinity College and Spanish. But this guy matched me word for word. Even on technical issues, he was outstanding. And I haven't ever met anybody since who emerged from jail with such fluency. His Irish was perfect. Now, I know he had a good ear. He was musical and he wrote poetry and all the rest. But my God, his Irish was extraordinary. For a guy who learned it, I would suspect for the greater part in jail, because he was born and reared in an absolutely Protestant estate called Rathcoole outside Belfast. So he wouldn't have been accessed to Irish in an area like that.
Yeah, and did he strike you at that time as somebody who was as determined as he turned out to be?
Yes. I remember discussing the killing of Earl Mountbatten and members of his family at Bullockmoor in the boat, and he was unrepentant. He was dogmatic that this guy, Mountbatten, knew exactly what the problems were historically in Ireland involving the British. And as far as he was concerned, he came here every year, came to Sligo every year to avail of the hospitality and the well-being of the Irish people. And yet he said he didn't do anything to ameliorate the situation and the British presence and all of that. So he had no sympathy whatsoever. He was as hard as nails in his disposition. But what is remarkable about what was remarkable was his disposition, because when you see images of Bobby Sands on the murals in West Belfast, or what the locals call the Muriels in West Belfast, there's this young man, a handsome young man with free-flowing locks, dark hair, and the picture of good health. But the man I met was emaciated. He was gaunt. He had long, greasy, lank hair, and his eyes darted all over the place. He seemed to me to be suffering terribly from a lack of proteins or vitamins of some nature, or perhaps he'd spent so much time in isolation and on the boards, and perhaps he was getting a bad time physically from some of the prison guards. I don't know, but my God, he was scary looking when I met him. But brilliantly articulate. I didn't think he missed a beat in his articulation, in how he saw his position and all of that.
Yeah, and I suppose it should be pointed out, you know, a lot of people in the IRA would have had certain disposition towards the royal family and what have you, and you Mountbatten in that regard, but also on that boat who were blown to bits was an 83-year-old woman and two 15-year-old children, effectively, and they were dispatched with the same ruthlessness as was Lord Mountbatten, or Earl Mountbatten, whatever is his title.
There was a little boy from Enniskillen who helped them during the summer called Paul Maxwell.
Yeah.
And that little fellow was killed as well. You know? So there were all families. There was a humanity attaching to them all, you know. I hated that violence. And I came from an SDLP family. Essentially, my family would have voted SDLP. But despite the fact that I was strictly constitutional in disposition, it didn't impede my curiosity about people who used violence for political purpose. And that's why I was determined to investigate and to try and understand why these people did what they did.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's, of course, the great journalistic instinct you had. Now, I also found interesting, Eamon, in your account in terms of the hunger strike period, the attitude on the other side of the fence, so to speak, in terms of some of those within the British establishment, but the attitude of some people towards the hunger strikers, and particularly give account of a senior civil servant, David Gilliland. Tell me about him.
David Gilliland had been around for a long time. He was the director of communications when William Whitelaw was here. He was the first Secretary of State of Northern Ireland when the Stormont collapsed at the time, way back then. And I had known David Gilliland a long time, but I wouldn't have had a very even relationship with him. He was a tricky enough customer, but he was now retired a long time when I was researching my book. And I knew that he was on the seven-man committee, in fact, strategizing on behalf of the Thatcher government during the hunger strike at Stormont. So I called him up and I asked him, would he meet me? And he said, I will. And when I met him, he said to me, did you think I would meet you? And I said, I simply didn't know. And then he said, I'll tell you why. I agreed to meet you. I always thought you were a wee C. But one thing I always knew, you were only interested in the story. It was an extraordinary thing to say to me. But that's what he said. I always thought you were a wee C. But I knew one thing, you were only interested in the story. And then he proceeded to talk about the hunger strike from their perspective. And he came up with this extraordinary remark when he said, my reading of the cabinet was, this is a reference to Bobby Sands as he was coming close to death, let the herd die. Let the herd die, he said. And I thought that was the right thing to do. It was an extraordinary remark, cruel. You could describe it as crude, but he didn't back away from it. That's what he said.
Yeah, cruel is right. And not for the first time, nor possibly the last, a huge element of stupidity coming from that quarter in terms of how to deal with the ancient quarrel on this island.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
No, one of your biggest stories, Eamon, was, and this is the happy side of things, and that is ultimately the conclusion of violence, which was begun through a series of secret talks that involved the likes of Gerry Adams, John Hume. There was contacts with the Irish government. There had been separately ongoing contacts with the British government, which would never be admitted at the time because of the outcry there would have been. But you were central to breaking that story.
It was a remarkable thing, you know. You know, people are always deeply suspicious that people with vested interests drop a story to a journalist at any level of society. And that is true. Sometimes people do. But the biggest story, probably one of the biggest stories of my entire career, was just my nose, my instinct. I heard Archbishop Robert Eames, the Protestant Archbishop of Ireland, on Radio Ulster one evening. And I'd heard him previously about 2 or 3 months earlier. And when he stopped speaking, I said to my wife, Detta, who's from Galway, I said, Detta, do you know something? I don't have a particularly good relationship with that man, but I've just listened to him now, and I listened to him a few months earlier. And that guy is saying something. There's something subliminal in what he's saying. I have an instinct he's saying something. So when he was off air, it was a telephone interview he was doing, I picked up the phone and I rang him, and I said, you know, Archbishop, we've had a hot and cold relationship over the years, but I just wanted to call you to say to you, I am fascinated by what you're saying. I heard you just a while ago on Radio Ulster, and I heard you 2 or 3 months earlier, and my nose tells me you are saying something. And he said, why don't you come and see me, Eamon? I was in his house in Armagh the next morning. And he didn't tell me very much, and I knew not to push him too far, but he said one thing to me. He said, Eamon, very, very few people know about this. Now, he didn't say what it was, but I left confident that I was on the right track. Now, that was February, March 1993. It took me until November 1993 to get the smoking gun. I phoned all the regular conspiratorial unionists I knew, and nobody had any idea, had heard anything. I didn't give up. I kept going. And then sometime late in autumn, in early November or so, I had checked with Republicans. They had denied anything. I'd been on to Downing Street many times. Jonathan Haslam was the senior person there. And he said, this old twaddle has been around for a long time, he said, but take it from me, it's not happening. Every time The Secretary of State, Patrick Mayhew, turned up on a Tuesday on the ground when he went out to various locations. I turned up, asked him the same question. Are you communicating in any manifestation with the IRA? And he would give the stock answer. You know our positions, we don't intrigue with the friends of the IRA or with Republicans. That's the way it is. This went on and on and on. And then it was like the last throw of the dice. Somebody said to me, you should check him in with Willie McRae. He was a Mid-Ulster MP. So I called William McRae and he said, Eamon, I was in my office at Westminster. He was an MP at that stage. I share an office with Dr. Paisley. And he said, there was a phone call to Dr. Paisley's office. And I answered the phone. Mr. Paisley wasn't there. And this guy alleged that the British government from the top down were engaged in conversations with the IRA at the very top. Now, he said, this guy who called had a very cultured accent, and he said, I will give you the proof in the coming days. So here I am talking to Willie McRae, saying, listen, I've been told contact has been made, and I'm expecting a communication fairly soon. I said to William, well, listen, if you get that communication, ring me immediately. So I would say within 2 or 3 hours, the phone rang, and it was William on the phone. And he said, Eamon, I got a correspondence here. I had to pick it up, and here it is. And he started reading it. And he came to this word, and he tripped over it, and he tried it again, and he tripped over it. The word was interlocutor. Now, I knew only somebody of a legal background would use a term like interlocutor. So I said, listen, William, put in the facts. There were no emails in those days. Put in the facts. My heart was thumping because I knew potentially now I had the smoking gun. So it landed and I read it. And I thanked William and I said, right, okay, this is the deal, William. If you don't talk to anybody about this, when I break this story, I'll give you your day in the sun. That's okay, he said. So now I had this extraordinary document, which was very specific, and it was clearly the Secretary of State, Patrick Mayhew, had dispatched the document. And in that document to the IRA and Sinn Féin, it was very specifically stated in the first few lines, be assured every word and line in this document is written by the Secretary of State, apart from the opening remarks referencing the document below. So I now have this remarkable document. But if I had been wrong, and this was my feeling at the time, I would have to give up my career. I could not continue as a journalist. Such was the seriousness of what I was alleging. Here you had a former Attorney General, Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. If I were wrong, he could sue me. He could call the Archbishop of England, of Canterbury, to give evidence on his behalf. He could call the then Attorney General to give evidence against me, affidavits or whatever. I wouldn't have a leg to stand upon. But I took steps then to try and authenticate it as best I could. I went to a QC called James McSparren, who had vast experience of government documents. I showed him the document. He read it twice, three times. And he said, Eamon, I would say that's 1,000% correct, but you can't use it. I said, sir, I didn't come here to ask you for an editorial decision. I came here to get a legal opinion based on your experience. And then I drove to Derry, and I met John Hume, and I showed him the document, and we were sitting at a pub in Derry, and he read the document once or twice, and he fell back against the wall, and you would think I'd hit him with a sledgehammer. And he said, I would say that's correct. And he said, I have been talking to Adams all this time. I've been talking to the British, and behind my back, the British were talking to the IRA. Adams didn't tell me, and the British didn't tell me. And then, of course, Patrick Mayhew and the permanent Undersecretary of Northern Ireland offered their resignation to John Major because I exposed them. And John Hume went to John Smith, the opposition leader, the Labour leader, and begged him not to put a motion of no confidence in Mayhew or John Major, on the grounds that he said the peace process is bigger than one man. And Major survived, and so did Patrick Mayhew. It was an extraordinary moment. But one of the people in the chain between the IRA and the government, he took me out for lunch sometimes later, and he said to me, at one stage we considered co-opting you. Now, it's a spy term that is bringing you on the inside to control you, or else to get you to work for the inside.
Were you co-optable, to use the phrase?
Well, clearly they must have concluded I wouldn't be, because they had nothing on me, obviously. But it was an extraordinary moment when he told me that they considered co-opting me.
Absolutely. And you mentioned John Hume there, Eamon, and Gerry Adams, both, of course, of who were central to the... Well, Adams was central to a lot of things prior to the peace process, but John Hume, I think an awful lot of people consider that he was really the architect to a large extent of what evolved. But they were obviously huge figures in that, those two men. But, and I think some people might find this surprising, it was really, the way it was set out in the book, I found very interesting. The person, on a personal basis, you seem to have taken more to, and someone you developed, I would suggest, probably a friendship with, was not John Hume or even Gerry Adams, but Ian Paisley.
Yes, he was a remarkable man, you know, in many ways. There were many sides to Ian Paisley, you know. He was very Irish in disposition. He was a great raconteur. He was a really, really fun man in so many different ways. But he would say the most extraordinary things about Catholics and about politicians in the Irish Republic. He used to poke fun at Peter Barry. He called him Teabags Barry. And when it came to Charles Haughey, he used to get a nickname from Hee-Haw Haughey. What sort of what country would have any self-respect having a Taoiseach, a Prime Minister called Haughey-Hee-Haw? He would play on names. When Douglas Hurd became the Secretary of State here, he was going out one evening to give an address, and he said to Eileen, his wife, "I haven't got a name for this boy yet." And she said, "How about Hurd the Turd?" And he would come up with some extraordinary names to denigrate. Roy Mason was a tiny little man who spoke to pipe, and he called him Tin Pint Size Mason. He said, "I never knew whether the pipe held him or he held the pipe." He had no respect for British politicians, English politicians. And during the Ulster Workers' Council strike, Harold Wilson, the then Prime Minister, came to Stormont to have a private meeting with Paisley. And during the course of that meeting, they set Wilson up. Wilson was a small man, and they put him in a big, high, shiny-backed leather chair. And he kept sliding down the chair, and they were pasting him, abusing him, and beating him left, right, and centre with all sorts of accusations and allegations and all that type of thing. And out of frustration, Wilson put his hand in his pocket, took out his pipe, and tried to light it. And if he failed to light the pipe several times. And eventually, out of frustration, he put the pipe back in his pocket. And the next thing Paisley told me, there was a chimney of smoke issuing from his pocket. Well, I could still hear Paisley roaring with laughter at the fate of poor old Harold Wilson. That was Paisley. He was unbelievable. I remember standing outside his headquarters one day, and this poor man, who was the worst of drink, came up to him and said to him, "Keep it up, big man." And the next thing, Paisley walked into the press conference, and out of nowhere, he shouted, the man in the street is saying, "Keep it up, big man, keep it up, big man." He was a master orator. He turned something always to his advantage.
Why do you think you and he developed such a good relationship?
It's just one of those imponderables. I do not know. From the moment I turned up on his doorstep in 1976, we just hit it off. And thereafter, he leaked some of the best stories he ever got. He was unbelievable in terms of how he treated him. And the BBC had beaten the path to his door to get his life story when he stepped down. He wouldn't give it to anybody. And I approached him a number of times down the years to ask if he would cooperate with me to write his biography. And he used to say, "Eamon, do you want to get me shot?" a man from Cross MacLean writing my biography. But a young junior Pacey dropped into our house one day, and I asked him, was his father doing anything about his memoirs or anything like that, writing or recording anything? He was now out of public life. And he said, we are distraught. He'll do nothing. The next morning, the phone rang, and Rhonda Pacey was on the at the other end of the line, Mr. Pacey's oldest daughter. And she said, Eamon, Mom and Dad would like to see you. And I went over, and I met him, and he said, I'd like you to work with me on my biography. Now, he was 82 at that stage, I think. And I said to myself, he doesn't realize the volume of work here, how long that would take. So I said, will you excuse me a moment? I went out into the kitchen. I spoke with Mrs. Paisley and Rhonda. I said, listen, I was best doing the research and coming here with the camera. And I tell him each week what I want to discuss in terms of the subject, but I will not be giving anybody questions or anything like that. And I went back into the room in the presence of Mrs. Paisley and his daughter, Rhonda, and I explained to him what my thinking was. And he said, that's all right. And off we went. And that's the way it happened. And we were there with my son was the producer, director. And we were he's in the business and he's now a film producer. He was one of the ones who made the film on Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares. So that was my experience at Paisley. And he went into a great deal about how the church dumped him, his own church, the church he founded, how it dumped him because he had gone into government with Martin McGuinness and then the party killed him off again. Because of the Tucker brothers' friendship with Martin McGuinness and because he had an amazing empathy and relationship with Bertie Ahern, he invited Bertie up to his constituency, didn't talk to the party about it, and they determined to destroy him. And they did. They killed him off. And he decided then to tell the full story. And he gave me the unabridged version of what exactly had happened to him inside the church and inside his party.
Another major figure whom you, I think you socialised a bit with him in the course of a project was Charlie High. I think you found his lodgings, if we might call it that, his mansion, pretty ostentatious up there.
Oh, gosh, I could write a book on this alone, you know. It was the most extraordinary experience. I was there for 3 days. And my wife, who was with me one day, she counted the number of portraits of himself he had on the wall. She counted 12. But the first day I went there, I'd phoned in advance to ask him would he meet me and discuss his ground floor input to the peace process. And politicians and historians and political scientists in the Republic of Ireland haven't given them any attention on this front, just as, in my opinion, they have done an injustice to the contribution that the Queen made when she came to Dublin. I'm still baffled by the inattention that was given to the Queen's visit and in many, many ways to Haughey's contribution to the peace process. But when I arrived at Abbeville that day in Kinsealy, there was a cock pheasant and a number of hen pheasants walking about under the tree on that beautiful morning. And I knocked the door and Haughey came to the door himself. And I was quite shocked how small he was, although I had seen him many times dressed up. And he looked rather disheveled, to tell you the truth. But I said, I was just watching the cock pheasant over there with the hens. And he said, oh, yeah, oh, aye. He said, there he is over there strutting his stuff among the hens. And I couldn't help thinking that there was some dimension of his own personality coming through in the way that he spoke about the cock pheasant and the hens, you know. And then we went into the lobby of the vestibule, I suppose you would call it, or the foyer of his mansion. And there was a painting hanging on the left-hand wall. And it was a painting by the Cork painter, Patrick Hennessy. And I said, that's a good Hennessy. And he said, oh, there's a great story about that Hennessy. It was a white horse drinking at a pool on a sunlit day. And he drew my attention to a moon in the top corner. And the moon represented the month or the time, the year in which Hennessy painted the picture. It was the year man landed on the moon. And he gave me the details of the background to the painting. And then he proceeded to tell me that he bought the picture, brought it home, and discovered that it hadn't been signed. He rang Leo Smith's gallery and he said, the next time Mr. Hennessy's in town, ring Mairead or Moyne or his partner, whoever, his secretary, and I'll send the car to bring Mr. Hennessy out. So he dutifully did that, and Hennessy came out, and the two boys started drinking. And alas and alack, the next morning when Hockey was walking around, looking at his paintings, admiring this painting again, what do you know? There was no signature on it. Hennessy had come, they had dined and wined, and Hennessy had left, and the picture still wasn't signed. I looked to the right of the hallway, and there was a painting by Harry Robinson Craig. I said, oh, The Lover. And he said, oh, he said, I didn't know you knew anything about this stuff. Well, I'd written several books about Irish art, so I knew who Hennessy was and Harry Robinson Craig, and they were both homosexual, and they'd lived in Morocco and Algiers for many years as artists. So I didn't get any work done. We went through the house. We discussed literature. We looked at paintings. We talked about Brehon Law, beekeeping, and we dined very, very well. I don't drink. So we had a wonderful time. And then in the course, the next time I went to see him, when I was finished the first section of my interview, he said to me, you know Basil Blackshaw, the artist? I said, I know him very well. Well, he said, I wonder when he paint my horse flashing steel. So I arranged for Basil to come and see him. And the two boys sat down for lunch and the drink flowed. And the next time when we went back to travel to the Curragh to see Flashing Steel, we started out again with lunch. We had lunch and George served all the lunch with the silver platters and the dome and all. And the Verve Clicquot flowed. And by the time I left going to the Curragh to see a Flashing Steel, Basil was drunk. And of course, we went in the state car. So we went down and Basil saw the horse and we came back. And when we came back, I noticed a bag hanging on the passenger window of my Jeep. And I got out to look at this bag. And what do you know? There was a bottle of Verve Clicquot hanging on the window, on the mirror of the car. And when I showed it to Basil, I told him, Basil was a Protestant, I said, in the Catholic Church, when one is dying, one is given what's called the Holy Viaticum. It's the food for the journey. But Charlie decided to give you some drink for the journey home. Well, Basil laughed, and he told that story over and over again for years afterwards. So eventually, and he did the painting, and we brought it back, and we were talking in the hallway, and Charlie said, okay, let's see the horse. So we went out into the car, brought in the horse, put it on the coffin table in the hallway, and Charlie looked at it, and he said to Basil, give me your hand, put out your hand. And he spat on his hand, and Basil's hand now was outreached, and down came Charlie's hand, and the deal was done. He said, I love it. There were like two Irish horse dealers at a Ballinasloe horse fair 40 years ago. We had a remarkable time with them. You know, it was such fun.
And tell me, Eamon, obviously I'm a hugely colourful character, but what did you think then when everything comes out about how he funded such a lavish lifestyle?
I didn't discuss that. It wasn't my business. I was there to research and investigate what contribution he'd made to the peace process. And he told me about Father Reed coming to see him. He told me about the ongoing communications he was receiving from Father Reed. And it now transpires that he was also getting direct communications from Gerry Adams via Father Reed. And Gerry Adams wanted a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with Hockey. But Hockey was running for election at this time, and Hockey would not agree to meet Adams. And the reason was, at one stage, he said to me, you know, because of the armed trial and everything like that, he couldn't meet Adams face to face. I understand that according to what Hockey told me, the Cardinal of Fee was potentially going to set up a secret meeting in Maynooth between Hockey and Adams. So that didn't happen. So anyhow, come what may, Hockey told Father Reed, if you can persuade John Hume to engage in discussions with Adams, then Hume would be my proxy. And effectively, that's what happened. Adams and Hume started to talk, and the rest we heard of was Hume Adams and all that flowed from that.
Yeah, and I think you do have a point. Charlie Eyen very divides opinion, and the way he came across 8 million from benefactors and what that may have done to politics domestically is a massive blemish on his whole career. However, I think it is also true, as you point out, that he has not received due credit for being in there at the beginnings of the peace process and getting thing moving.
Well, you know the old story, the good is often buried with the bones.
That's very true. That's very true. Eamon, it's been terrific. And I have to say, I would highly recommend your book. I think it's both entertaining and informative, and it really captures a really crucial time, harrowing in places, but vital and central to our recent history on the island. Eamon Malley, the book is Eyewitness to War and Peace. Eamon, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Delighted, and thank you for entertaining me. Thank you very much indeed.
Also, as always, I'd like to thank our engineer, JJ Fernan. Thank you, folks, for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week. Take it easy.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.